All right, I guess we're gonna start now. My name's Christina, and Stoss, and we're gonna sort of be presenting, I guess, an anarcho-communist view of environmentalism, since there seems to be sort of this break between the class struggle and eco-anarchists in a way, and since the class struggle hasn't exactly addressed it too much, and since a lot of anarchists seem to be into environmentalism, maybe some progress could be made since environmental destruction is still a very rampant and important part of it. So we are presenting this more of an outline to get a discussion to bring up issues and to figure out how to progress with it for a paper we want to do. So we're just trying to get a little basic outline so we can expand the paper. So we're going to start with some tendencies and then go to environment related to capitalism and class, and then environment and class struggle sort of analysis, and maybe a little anarcho-communist vision. So, yeah.
Okay, so I'm starting off by sort of discussing the two tendencies, if you will, the red versus the green. And I'll start with our own sort of anarcho-communist tendency, or the red tendency, if you will. And I guess the basic sort of premise of the anarcho-communist tendency is the ancient pathetic slogan of communism, from each according to ability, to each according to need, which defines the idea of a sort of communist society, regardless of whether it's the state communist or the anarcho-communist society. But the way that we envision, particularly our NEFAC sort of vision, and a lot of this is coming straight out of the NEFAC Aims and Principles statement on anarcho-communism, is that we sort of see a society of radically democratic, self-managed communities and workplaces, so that we're looking for a direct democracy in terms of the social organization of just about everything, beginning with the community, stretching out to every aspect, whether it's education, whether it's workplace, and any other sort of aspect of society. And we see these sorts of local direct democratic structures being federated, both in terms of taking a smaller sort of workplace versus community, or workplace and community structures, federating them together and into sort of larger and larger federations based on mutual aid, because obviously, as much as we'd like to create sort of self-sustaining communities with the population densities we have, and with the way that our world is currently organized, it seems likely that a large federation of communities would be better able to provide mutual aid to one another, both in terms of productive sort of capacities, you know, getting things from one place to another, whether it be food or basic materials, such as materials for housing, materials for healthcare, materials for just about, you know, any sort of kind of infrastructure, and needs in terms of, you know, sort of personal needs. Let's say a community needs extra people to either defend itself against hostile threats from, you know, a group of white supremacists or something, or it has to recover from a natural disaster. This sort of federated structure allows people to be able to go from one community to another, to be able to help one another. A large thrust of the anarcho-communist vision is, of course, the abolition of capitalism, and with the abolition of capitalism comes the abolition of the wage system, the restructuring of the way that we sort of function in terms of the workplace, in terms of the economic system, so that everything in terms of economic structure is socialized. Control of workplaces, control of the economy becomes that of the workers, at least in terms of the workplace. The workers take control of what they're doing. In terms of the distribution systems, communities take control of distribution because of this idea going back to from each according to ability to each according to need. People produce what they can, and they grant to those who need it. It's very simple. And we reject this idea of sort of a permanent division of labor, that capitalism is structured on a hierarchical division of labor within both the social realm and the productive realm, the economic realm, where, you know, there is a vast majority of people who are workers who have no control over their workplace, and then there's a sort of middle structure of people who are the managerial class, those people who follow through with the orders of the capitalist elite, who are the owners, the people who take up positions of government and positions of control, and basically send the orders to the managerial class, which then relays the orders and controls those who are the vast majority of the workers. That division of labor we want to see abolished. We want to see a world where that vast majority of workers can control that workplace without having to take orders from others and without having to have a middle managerial class giving them orders. So the abolition of those two sort of upper classes. And we also see with the abolition of capitalism, the abolition of a certain sort of level of commodity exchange. So that, you know, in a current capitalist society, we have this idea that, one, our notion of labor is one where we sell our labor as a commodity to be exchanged for other commodities in the marketplace. Labor becomes something simply a necessity of life, that we produce. We labor to produce things that we need for life, and those things are then distributed evenly to the society. Consumption becomes something based on need rather than something based on social status, based on ability to buy, based on our way of differentiating. You know, it's sort of related to this idea of division of labor, that in that division of labor, our ability to consume is sort of defined by where we sit in the labor structure. And of course, you know, within that working class structure, some people are better able to consume than others, but that's more a function of the fact that we live in a society that's relatively affluent in its capitalist form. And it's not something that's defined necessarily by a structure within, say, you know, it's not something that there's a specific element of the working class who are in many, you know, while they're qualitatively different in many ways, they're also qualitatively similar. And that pretty much sort of brings us to that, the whole idea of the commodity brings us to the last aspect of anarcho-communism, in that when you abolish this idea of sort of a free market exchange or a market exchange where things are sold, things are no longer commodities, the things that exist in the world, you know, everything from the bottle to the bench over there or the picnic table, those commodities become commodities based on their use value, based on what role they serve in the society and not in what they can be sold for. So that everything that is produced because there's a use for it. You no longer produce things because you can sell them. You know, there's a million things that our society produces that you don't really need, at least in terms of the quantity that they're produced. They're simply produced because you can sell them and not because anyone really needs them. The anarcho-communist vision is to produce because people need, so that either the quantity is reduced or the item is eliminated altogether in sort of our later vision that we'll project. So in terms of the brief sort of overview of the green tendency, or at least the way that we understand the green tendency, is that there seem to be sort of a variety of green tendencies in anarchism, and they run the gamut from certain perspectives which view the whole of civilization as being problematic, the whole organization of modern civilized society as being intrinsically hierarchical, and that the institutions that have developed out of this notion of civilization, the concepts that have developed out of this notion of civilization, are in and of themselves both hierarchical and intrinsically destructive towards our own humanity and the environment, so that there's a significant critique of division of labor as being in and of itself problematic. And the division of labor is not the way that the anarcho-communist vision projects a division of labor, where it's a division of those who give orders and those who take orders. It's this division of labor that those who have the ability to perform a specific task versus another specific task can intrinsically develop hierarchies based on the idea that different skill levels can create hierarchy, and that that sort of division of labor in and of itself is problematic. That notions of production in and of itself are problematic, that the idea of sort of mass production of anything is in and of itself problematic because it's alienating, because it eliminates certain connections that we have with our natural being and our natural way of looking at the world. And also that one of the byproducts of this productive method, of this division of labor, and of this social construction, technology, is in and of itself problematic because technology brings with it power relations and power imbalances that are significantly both alienating in terms of what Marx would call sort of your species being, which is a really fancy word for what we sort of consider our humanity, what is our natural sort of human tendencies. Technology both alienates that, and it creates this sort of alienation from the natural world that allows us to behave in a way that is destructive and problematic. Then, of course, there are also green tendencies that are sort of more critical in the way that we are organized vis-a-vis nature, that our relationship to nature is one of a power relationship and an exploitative relationship based on sort of systems of domination, that we dominate each other, human beings, through various forms, be they class, race, gender, and that same system of domination is then projected onto nature, and so we dominate nature in that same sort of way. We develop hierarchical relationships with various aspects of nature, and we see ourselves as being apart from nature instead of a part of nature. And so the world that we have constructed is one where we try to dominate the environment as a whole, and we try to exploit it in the same ways that other power relationships exploit the differences between human beings in terms of class or race. We exploit the difference between us as human beings and nature as something completely different and existing outside of ourselves. And I apologize for the very brief overviews of the green tendencies. But again, this is sort of an overview.
Do you want to name them just for specifics for people?
I'd rather not, so I don't get in trouble for misrepresentation, since it's not our tendency.
All right, so I'll go ahead and talk about environmental problems and how they relate to capitalism and class. And relating to capitalism, and probably a lot of people are familiar with this, so I'm not going to go too much into detail. It seems especially that capitalism with the protection of the state is a major cause of a lot of these environmental problems. And the problems are linked together in a complex web. Like, one problem goes down the line, creating more. It's like an exponential thing. And capitalism puts profit over life, and it sort of decreases the value of both humans and the environment. And of the capitalist society creates this marketing, consumption, throwaway society where we have less non-renewable resources and non-renewable technologies, and even there's been a lot of talk on credit, I hear, and that furthers the consumption, so it's just exponentially growing. And this waste is creating, like, oftentimes toxic and can't be absorbed by the environment. And through this capitalist system, there's causing in the nature, there's loss of habitat, there's decrease in biodiversity, global warming, and pollution of air, water, and land. And also what capitalism does is it creates this division where the people making the rules in order to create this system of production aren't influenced by the working class. So the working class are trapped in this wage-slave sort of environment, and they're oftentimes the subjects or the people that have to physically harm the environment, but they're also the ones that take the impact, where the upper class people put the orders and they don't see the environmental destruction often, and they don't feel the total effects of it. And many times when the workers have these jobs that destroy the environments that they live around, they know that they do, but they're caught into continuing to do it in order to raise their families or for different reasons. So we think as anarcho-communists that the working class are the way to a social revolution because they start and stop the production, as someone said in the NEFAC talk. So linking environmentalism with class is really important because it's the way to sort of, I believe, have a stronger movement that actually stops the root of this destruction. And this is amplified by globalization now because they exploit other resources and going into different places and using the natural resources that the communities often had. And this also connects with race and patriarchy in different ways, especially with now and how things are with environmental racism, how lower income areas oftentimes colored get more toxic waste dumps, and they get more of the like air pollution, and the kids end up getting more asthma, and there's more rates of cancer. So this whole concept of environment class really needs to be linked in order to go with the workers and create a struggle that is stronger rather than having a struggle that is based on just creating new, not new technology, but like green products that are just more of a new market. And Stas is going to talk a little more about exact environmental struggles and class struggles, how they're related.
I'm going to go sort of out on a limb here and say that almost all environmental struggles are ultimately class struggles. And I think in saying this, and the reason I use the term almost and not say every environmental struggle is a class struggle, is that there is a certain class division in the types of environmental struggles that exist. There's a certain level of preservation movements that are part of the environmental struggle that are oriented around a middle-class consciousness and a middle-class view of the world, where they see this thing that belongs to them that is nature that must be preserved. And, you know, it's preserved in the pristine sort of photograph, picture, postcard kind of way. And that's a really sort of middle-class way of looking at things. But I would say that the vast majority of actual environmental struggles are struggles of class that are based around struggles against either capitalism in terms of addressing what's sort of known as the externalities of production, because a lot of what occurs in terms of what we see as environmental destruction, both in forms of pollution through dumping, in forms of pollution through the waste products that come out through the productive process, in terms of smoke, in terms of waste products just being dumped in any sort of area. These are known as externalities because in terms of basic sort of economics, these are things that are not covered in the equation of the cost of production. They're the things that are given to the community to deal with in terms of cost. So they're externalized. And so therefore, a lot of struggles that we see around environmentalism are struggles against these sorts of externalities, or they're struggles against directly being the element of production, so that we see with a struggle against, say, logging, or struggles against various forms of mining, struggles against various forms of overfishing, of various forms of marine environmental struggles, are ones that are based around this idea that the actual productive elements are being overused to an extent by capitalism, overexploited by capitalism in a way that's destructive to the environment. The other thing, as Christina mentioned, in terms of environmental struggles as class struggles, is that victims of the most grievous sort of environmental hazards are the poor and working class individuals. We see workplace exposure as a great site of environmental class struggle, where workers are directly exposed to hazardous chemicals, and they find themselves struggling basically to stay alive, both in terms of, you know, their day-to-day labor activities and trying to make a living sort of wage in terms of being able to support themselves and their families, but also to stay alive in that they are exposed to these sorts of hazards in their day-to-day struggle to stay alive, which ultimately kill them, and they bring them home and expose their families to various chemical and airborne toxins. And also in terms of the displacement of these externalities that I talked about, there's the notion of environmental racism, environmental classism. In the state of Massachusetts, of the 15 worst dump sites, the most hazardous sites in terms of environment in the state of Massachusetts, 9 of them are in communities of color, and all 15 are in poor communities, you know, or poor working communities. So that when we look at the sort of grassroots movements and not the large-scale, you know, Sierra Club, Audubon Society, Let's Preserve Nature kind of movements, when we look at the grassroots movements that are really struggling to confront environmental damage in terms of externalization and in terms of being the victims of environmental destruction, we see these as being movements that are mostly working class or movements that are formed in working class and poor communities. And some good examples of that are in Baltimore, there is a neighborhood sort of in the southern part of the city, broadly known as Brooklyn, and it has a more specific sort of name as neighborhoods tend to have, as they're delineated, which was essentially at one time all residential and working class, and over time it became surrounded by oil refineries, and it became a location of struggle between the working class residents of that neighborhood and the oil refineries that surround them, because they're being exposed to the toxic chemicals in the refinery process, and the levels of cancer were significantly high for that neighborhood. So that ultimately their struggle was one of direct action against the city to try to get them to try to get that neighborhood to not so much be cleaned up, because there's nothing they could do about being surrounded by the oil refineries. It was basically to try to get them out of the neighborhood, because being poor and working class, they didn't have the means to leave. They didn't have the economic means. You see in Boston struggles around various groups in neighborhoods around Roxbury, especially, which is a neighborhood that's working class people of color, around sort of the Tea Riders Union and various local groups coming together to fight against the idling of buses, because the smoke from buses sort of, it creates higher levels of air pollution, it creates higher levels of asthma than any other neighborhood in Boston. And you see campaigns such as Yucca Mountain, where campaigns against dumping of nuclear waste on Native American reservations were all campaigns by poor working-class Native Americans against toxic chemicals being dumped in their communities. And the people that pushed for this dumping were either, you know, rich white guys in the Senate, or the people that worked in these sort of local tribal councils who are known to have connections with the state, who are known to exploit their own people on the reservation, their own people, basically, for their own financial gain. So this is just sort of a brief sketch of this idea that environmental struggles are always class struggles, because they are struggles of people who are poor and working class, people who are of minority communities, against sort of larger capitalist, larger state powers. And now we're going to move on to a narco-communist sort of vision of a society that involves a certain incorporation of environmental practices.
Stas talked a little bit about anarcho-communism in the beginning, so I guess that should be the basic outline. But as for communities, locally organized communities that are equally organized in a directly democratic, non-hierarchical manner, and that has a social system where access to commodities is defined by need rather than like ability to afford, and that social status is not defined by material possession, where this should decrease people's consumption patterns, and hopefully it would create a way in which we can have the products needed to survive, and with technology that is very adaptable and doesn't put any toxic waste into the environment that it can't naturally absorb. And also with smaller scale communities, it makes it easier to make decisions resulting in what is happening around and how it is affecting people. But also on a larger scale with the Federation, there can be communication between the communities, and you can see like the global vision of the impact that what your community is doing on maybe others in some way, or just helping each other keep this ecologically sound place.
The other sort of important element of the anarcho-communist vision of a future society is, you know, sort of incorporating this anarcho-syndicalist idea of worker control. And worker control is sort of critical in that if we sort of accept this notion that it is production or the production process as it exists now that creates a large portion of the environmental hazards that we have in terms of the externalities that I briefly talked about, then worker control of that production and workers understanding that the production that they're doing has an impact on the environment is critical towards making those sorts of changes. So that, you know, some of the basic sort of elements, such as, you know, workplace exposure, you know, if you control your workplace, you are not going to, you know, have yourself or your coworkers exposed to toxic chemicals. It's almost, you know, common sense that, you know, only someone who is detached from that sort of production process would give those sorts of orders, would make those sorts of demands. You know, that's sort of a first stage in alternating the productive process. Because, you know, once you make that decision, then clearly you're going to reduce the use, you know, not only reduce, but totally eliminate the use of toxic elements in the production process and find alternative ways to, if it's possible, you know, you may have to abandon certain production processes because the alternative method doesn't exist. There's always sort of this assumption by certain tendencies, you know, sort of the eco-anarchist movement, both primitivist and sort of socio-ecologist, I think, that sort of sees anarcho-communist, the anarcho-communist vision as being one that always incorporates modern forms of production. And, you know, to me it seems that if workers had control, they would have to find ways to not kill themselves, to not, you know, to not do things in a manner that's going to pollute them both at the workplace and in the home, so that you have, you know, the alternative forms being created. And if work is not confined to sort of being the dictates of a market economy, it opens up the space for people to both experiment with sort of reusable methods and recycling of various either waste products or of using materials that are recyclable and reusable but in the production process. And it allows people, it frees up people to work in those parts of the sort of post-production process that would be based around sort of both the reclamation of nature and the ability to keep the negative externalities in check, the various sort of recycling plants, the various sort of elements of society. It allows people to work in those sectors that may not have worked in them before. It allows people to go into those sectors that may not have gone into them before. I mean, a large aspect of... There's a hierarchy within the field of engineering, and the environmental engineers are at the bottom. And in a society that doesn't necessarily create a hierarchy of engineers, you could see more people going into environmental engineering because they understand their intrinsic worth in the society, and less people going into mechanical engineering because you don't need to invent a new product every 3 days to put it out on the market. It's just sort of common sense again. So that these changes in priorities would allow people to engage in activities that are not intrinsically harmful to the environment. So that's pretty much our brief analysis, critique, and vision. And we wanted to sort of open it up to people's comments, ideas, criticisms.